Hello there, and welcome to the 257th episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is Greg sitting in as host for Johnny, who, as was foretold last week, is not able to make it to tonight's recording of the show. But unfortunately, I have to report another missing member of our party tonight.
Barely a member.
Poor old John, living out on the East Coast in Boston these days, felt the wrath of Hurricane Irene, unfortunately, and he has got power now. At one point, we thought he wouldn't even have power at this point, but he does still lack internet access.
I would like to point out that I braved the much fiercer storm than John did and still made it.
Yeah, you've been through it all lately, the earthquake.
I am Ray.
Yeah, obviously, you at this point, you have got to be looking over your shoulder for the seemingly inevitable bear attack.
Bearists, yes. I fear them.
So, we're without John. But we soldier on because joining us is our favourite guest, the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, Michael TYP Cole.
Hey, guys. I feel like I'm always stepping in for John here.
Well, you've been on about as many episodes as him.
I hope he's faring okay, man. That sucks. He's internetless.
Yeah, I know. Well, of course, I'm sure we've got plenty of listeners who've been affected by the situation on the East Coast of the United States.
We're recording in Thursday, and there's still about 100,000 households that don't have power in the state of Virginia.
Yeah, it's really something, and we certainly send everyone our best wishes to get through this sort of difficult time, and hopefully we'll be able to provide a bit of fun here for a few hours, if you're able to hear us at this point.
Well, you know, if you're afraid of earthquakes, you can always move to California.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, it must be odd for you, too, if he's all looking on at the other seaboard.
It is, because it's, what was it, like a 5.9, which is serious, but it's not massive. But the thing is, in the East Coast, none of the buildings are really built for earthquakes.
No. So we feel it pretty good. And we're like, oh, what is that? What is going on? Yeah. Did a pipeline just blow up? What happened?
We will now commence new business, which we're going to begin with the Ambassador program, which just recently got rolled out. So the three of us, and I imagine quite a few of our listeners, have had the opportunity to download our 10 free of charge NES games for Virtual Console and 3DS.
I've got my certificate.
10 games plus the certificate.
That's right.
Let's not
that
forget
is the
that.
Most hack job thing I've seen on a Nintendo
it's
platform.
It's not even in 3D. It's not. It turns off the 3D mode. It's. What?
The amazing thing is for us, it's a 4-minute video that goes along with it, but it does actually scroll through a bunch of different languages on the text. So I was wondering, in the States, how does it fill the 4 minutes?
So we get English, Spanish, French, and Portuguese.
Well, that's more inclusive than I might have thought, actually.
Why a video? Why did they feel the need to have this giant,
it doesn't make any sense.
Giant file size piece of crap when they could have just done text?
Or just given me a song. Just give me the happy song for my menu. I mean,
the whole thing does feel a bit workaround-y, because of course you do download the games as if you'd already bought them and downloaded them before, but they weren't on your system anymore.
Yes.
So you're quote-unquote re-downloading them, even though of course you've never done it before.
Yes.
It's a hack.
My experience with the Welcome Back program, your PSN, was pretty bad because the store didn't really work properly at that point.
It was still broken.
They just put it back up. But I mean, I guess at least it was more explicit. Like you went to the store, there was this huge welcome back banner.
Yes.
Here, it's a bit more hidden. It's a topic we might actually return to in listener mail.
To be fair, about half the games in the eShop are hidden item games anyway. So,
well, the DSi
it fits.
You know, the best part of the whole thing is that, like, I think Nintendo sent out a press release or maybe like to the newsletter.
Yes, they did.
And it said all you have to do is simply do this, then this, then this, then this, then this, and then you're connected and you can download your.
It is one of the more it's one of the more amusing press releases they've sent out in the last few weeks, and they've sent out some doozies lately.
Yeah, so that part of it was a bit of a nuisance, especially because if you've downloaded quite a few things like I have, include like some videos and stuff, they count as downloads and therefore are kind of eligible to be re-downloaded.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a giant list.
So yeah, you've got a big list, and then like for me, a lot of those NES games are on the second page. So it's like, okay, I've downloaded one. Now it warps you all the way back out to the front page of the eShop. So go back to the re-download bit, scroll through the first page, go to the second page, scroll down through that.
Yeah, it's clearly a hack job, but at the same time, this is free, and I can understand why they wouldn't want to put too much effort into something that's a very temporary thing. At the same time, they're trying to appease people that may be kind of annoyed, and so giving them an unfriendly experience.
Let's make
maybe,
this annoying.
Yeah, so I mean, I can see why it is the way it is, but it's very tragic that they weren't able to come up with a more elegant solution without reinventing. They clearly would have had to reinvent the wheel just to add a new feature on the eShop, and that concerns me.
What I find funny is in the UK press release, remember to download your Nintendo 3DS Ambassador Certificate. Then you'll receive information about Virtual Console Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, so that certificate is just so you can switch on, yes, notify me when the GBA games are ready, please.
You know? So terrible.
And that, of course, is the second part that we're still waiting for. We're told, you know, by the end of the year, and they may well be, you know, a bit more sketchy than these NES games in terms of the interface, because they're not going to have the same kind of suspend features and stuff. I mean, this, to me, is very much like playing it on the Wii Virtual Console, because you suspend, you do have a manual. You know, it's pretty good. My experience so far, just dabbling in a little bit of Super Mario Brothers and this, that, and the other. I mean, some people might have raised issues about, you know, what the resolution of the games would look like on the screen, but the thing is, the native resolution of an NES game, I believe, is something like 256 by 224.
Yes.
So that's actually pretty close, in vertical terms, to the 3DS, because it's 400 by 240. So if it's doing a little bit of stretching, it's relatively modest compared to, like, with a regular DS game, it's significantly lower resolution than NES.
It looks very nice. I did notice that when you're playing a game where it's scrolling left or right, there's a little bit of kind of vertical banding that goes on, and I think that's to do something with either stretching or skewing slightly, or perhaps because the pixel sizes are slightly different between an LCD and a classic TV, which it might, and they might be adjusting for that to make the proportions look right.
I mean, it's conceivable as well that it could be some differences when we actually get the quote-unquote final versions of these, when they actually go on sale for the going public, as it were.
Well, and you have to keep in mind that the TVs, actual, you know, old-style TVs, kind of fudge things for them a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Which makes representing them difficult, I would assume.
Well, I mean, the amusing thing about the 3DS top screen, though, is that the nature of the pixels out there is like twice as many horizontal than vertical, just because, you know, the 3D effect, and when it's turned off, it's, I mean, the spacing between pixels horizontally is less than it is vertically. That almost gives it a TV-esque look. I mean, it actually does sort of create a facsimile of that effect that you would get with the kind of the thick pixels and old TVs, at least in the US.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think this is quite nice for the PAL Wii owners who've been playing Virtual Console games, NES. Yeah, they've had the problems with not running at full speed, being boarded and all that. That's not a problem here, you know, because it's not on a television. They've just given you the ROM that runs at full speed and everything. So that's nice. You know, I mean, I've got a Japanese Virtual Console, not so Virtual Console, so I have long since left that problem behind. But for a lot of people, I'd imagine it's like, oh yeah, you know, this is what Super Mario Brothers is supposed to be like, not like with this weird broken speed correction that speeds up the music.
Now, it'll be interesting to see if the final release, quote-unquote, fixes that.
Oh, don't even entertain that idea. That's awful.
But I will say, I think they look quite beautiful on the 3DS screen. It's probably the sharpest I've ever seen these games, because the colors are very vibrant on the 3DS screen. And, you know, on a Wii with an LCD, you know, there's going to be some scratching, which kind of blurs the effect a bit. And it looks quite sharp on the 3DS screen. Like I said, there's some sort of fudging of the resolution or pixel sizes that I noticed with Mario and Zelda 2. But it isn't too distracting. Overall, it looks quite nice. I'm quite happy.
Yeah, I'm pretty pleased with that part of it. So, I mean, just a, you know, the matter of the 10 games that we have here. So obviously we knew 5 of them before, and then the other 5 that we've got now, we've got Yoshi.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's known here as Mario and Yoshi.
Yes.
In Japan, is it Yoshi's Egg as well? It's just one of those ones that's got a different name everywhere. But it's
Everybody got its own name, except Australia.
That's the puzzle game. Then you've got NES Open Tournament Golf.
Which is not good.
You know, I agree. I didn't enjoy it. Is there another NES game golf game? Is this like a sequel to a...
Yeah, there was... We owned, my family owned, the predecessor to that. Which I'm looking at this on the Ambassador program now, I could see the similarities. I mean, clearly it sort of fancied things up a bit. Like, that had this sort of bizarre sort of realistic Mario as the golfer.
Yeah,
like, this
so
huge belly and all that. You know, like, so, whereas this is, you know, proper looking cartoon Mario.
Except he's in a pink suit, which is kind of weird.
Well, you know it's an interesting bridge game between the classic NES golf game and Mario Golf for the Game Boy Color. Because a lot of the visuals actually are similar to the Game Boy Color game, but the gameplay is probably closer to the crummy NES game.
Yeah, it seems like it plays pretty similarly to the game that I remember.
It's basically press A and then lose badly.
Well, the timing is really difficult, I found.
It's even on the slowest setting, that bar moves fast.
Yeah.
It's funny, I've been playing Mario Golf Advance Tour quite recently.
Oh yeah, the Golden Sun game, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been playing that, and I mean, the difference in how approachable those two games are is a bit more forgiving, the GBA game, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And then also we got Wreck-It Crew, which I've actually had some interest in for quite a while, because I understand it's kind of a cool puzzle platformer kind of thing, even though you can't jump in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're kind of Mario going around, you have to destroy everything in a given level, but you've got the obstacles like ladders and enemies to worry about and all that. So
it's Hotel Mario.
It looks a bit like that with some of those doors that you get in there.
All toasters toast.
And then we also had Zelda 2, which I think is a good choice for this in terms of being portable, might make it a bit more approachable for people.
It's already my favorite version of it because, you know, back on the NES, you had to basically leave it on to, to keep your experience. And then I got it on GameCube in that collection, and that didn't solve the problem because there was no save state. And I guess if you purchased the Virtual Console on Wii, you were in good shape. But this is, being portable really helps, I think, because it's a pretty meaty game, and it's one that you can really want to pick up, and especially if you're doing some grinding or whatever, you can do it in chunks now, and that's really good.
Yeah, so that's the thing. I got quite far when we did it for Retroactive on the Virtual Console, mm-hmm. but I think I might be able to get further now. So that's cool. And then lastly, Metroid. The original Metroid is there. I guess we should have seen this one coming, because they've been quite happy to give us the original 8-bit Metroid in whatever form. Remember it? You remember when you linked up Fusion and Prime?
Oh, yeah.
You got to play it through Prime, and then they put it on Zero Mission as well, which got kind of made it. Obviously, Zero Mission was based on it. NES Classics too. So
it's Nintendo's version of Puyo Puyo. It's just a throwaway thing you can get anywhere.
So again, I've tried in some of these venues that I just mentioned to get on with the original Metroid and never really succeeded. But maybe this time, with some of the conveniences of portability and the suspend feature and all that, I might actually manage it this time. So we've got the 10 games there. What of those are any of you in particular kind of looking forward to playing through again?
Well, clearly Zelda 2, because I went to give it a test drive and I found myself compelled to grind again in the first dungeon. I'm like, okay, I better put this down. This could go on for a while. So clearly I'll be playing that for a while. One game I am interested, like you said, is Wrecking Crew. I've never played that game, so I'm looking forward to that. I touched Donkey Kong Jr. It's not as fun as I remembered, so I'm not going to probably go back to that. But and I was interested in the Mario Golf game until I realized it was crap. So
it's so not good.
I don't know. Maybe if you get used to it. I do remember playing that golf game quite a lot, but you know, it's not like I had a lot of choice. Yeah. And when we got the PGA Tour for Genesis some years later, it did seem quite a lot better. I can see that. But for me, what I'm looking forward to is the original Legend of Zelda, because I have not touched that in a very, very long time. That, I think, is one of the first things I'm going to sort of make a real sustained attempt to get through. James, any of them?
So, last time I played the original Zelda, I just was struck by how utterly obtuse it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I really want to go back down that road.
I think it's still fun, but...
Right now, I'm playing good old open golf for the site, but once that's done, I guess I'll probably go to Wrecking Crew next, only because I've only played that once ever, mm-hmm. and that was a while ago.
Yeah, I mean, they're not giving away, it's a lot of black box games, you know, early NES stuff from the American, you know, launch period anyway. Not necessarily the juiciest kind of offerings that you might have had, you know, Mario 3, for instance.
Right.
You know, that's something that a lot of people might have wanted.
Yeah, well, except that's going to be in the GBA selection, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been the hint of that. That was kind of put out there and then pulled back on. You know, because someone, I think it wasn't in the original five, but then someone was talking to a Nintendo customer service rep, and they mentioned that the Super Mario Advance 4 version might be one of the games, but then they backtracked
Super
on that.
Super Mario Advance 4, Super Mario 3.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. So that isn't certain yet. Perhaps it will be, but even, I mean, the games that are on there, you know, still, I mean, games like Metroid, Zelda, Super Mario Brothers, I mean, they would have sold plenty of copies to these same people, so they've still made something of a sacrifice there, and I think I'm going to get plenty of use out of some of these, although I think it's true that the GBA games will be more meaty when we get those, you know, some of those offerings. So I'll be looking forward to that as well before the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these early NES games are really nothing more than arcade titles.
Well, yeah, but Super Mario Brothers, I mean, Zelda 2 is a long game.
Right.
Zelda 1 is a long game. Metroid, yes. If you've never played it before, becomes a long game.
Right, but like Wrecking Crew, Ice Climbers.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, some of these are things I would definitely not. I probably would have bought Golf and then been pissed. So
because then you'd be like, wait, this game is terrible. What was I thinking?
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm pretty satisfied with the selection they have.
Yeah, no, of course. I'm kind of getting used to the idea now of playing, you know, these old console games on the portable as well. I'm looking forward to just the whole range opening up. You know, I mean, I do hope that when we start bringing over the games for general sale on the eShop, that we get the same sort of range of like third parties putting their games on there as we did with the Wii Virtual Console, because yeah, there haven't been too much uptake so far on the portable side, you know, on the Game Boy stuff. Obviously, we've had some third-party games, particularly from Capcom, which we're going to kind of follow up on shortly. But I hope once they get these NES games going that we will have, you know, the Castlevanias and that kind of thing coming in relatively short order. But we'll now move on for the rest of new business, and TYP, as our guest, you're going to kick us off. So you've been playing what is becoming a sort of fixture on this show, Final Fantasy 3/6 for the Super Nintendo Virtual Console.
Yeah, I've been chewing on this for maybe a month or so now, and I'm actually at the very end. I'm at the final boss right now, so it's actually quite a good time to talk about this. So, as I think I mentioned on our previous episode, I have an odd history with Final Fantasy as a series, because...
Yeah, I guess 4 is the first one that you played through, right?
4 was the first one I played through. I got into RPGs right kind of at the tail of the Super Nintendo era, maybe a little bit in any N64 era, and so, you know, Super Mario RPG, Paper Mario, those were some of my first RPGs, so I almost took pride in never having played a Final Fantasy for a while, you know, because of the console wars and everything, but I played Final Fantasy IV, really liked that, and of course I've already played Chrono Trigger, and I really liked that, and I heard, you know, well, Final Fantasy VI is sort of somewhere in between those games, and Johnny's, you know, talks about it, and other people talk about it very highly, so it was a game I'd been on my radar for a long time. I had actually tried to find a GBA copy for some road trips a few times.
That's difficult to find.
It is very difficult to find. So when it finally came out on Virtual Console, I'm like, yes, I can finally buy this and just play it. So fresh look at the game, and I have to say, other than perhaps the random battle aspect of it, it still feels like a very modern Japanese RPG. And it's kind of funny for me because I've played other games that kind of aped it. Golden Sun, for example, the overworld is lifted straight out of this game. I mean, clearly the Mode 7 style overworld is very much aping Final Fantasy VI. And so it was sort of amusing to see a lot of these kind of things that I'd seen first in these knockoffs.
Yeah, that they were inspired by,
yeah,
it, at least.
Yeah, I mean, even some of the character designs. I mean, like, Terra's, not her artwork style, but the sprite art looks a lot like one or two characters from Golden Sun. Anyway, I've really enjoyed this game. I have to say, I think I like the first half of the game more. It's maybe a little more structured.
Oh, it's interesting you should say that, because I think where I got to is basically the end of the first half. I'm about 15 hours in, I think, maybe a little less. So I kind of got to the point that seems like it's a big turning point in the story.
Yeah.
And it was a bit tricky. I got stuck and I just haven't gone back to it yet. I think I could be able to get through it because it's not as hard as 4 for the DS.
It isn't as hard, but especially in the second half, as Johnny mentioned, it's kind of a very open world. It's very non-linear, not directed. And while it's very interesting and it provides for a lot of exploration and if you're into that, that's great. But I found myself quite lost, and I found myself kind of going to things sort of out of order in such a way that things were just too hard, and I was just sort of banging my head against a wall. I wound up using a guide for just telling me, okay, go to this place next, you know, at that level, and that really helped me enjoy the game and see everything in it, because there is a lot of stuff you can beat the game or attempt to beat the game with very few characters. It's sort of this searching to bring the band together kind of a thing. And there are points where it's like, well, you don't really know which CD to go to find a character necessarily. And most of them can be done out of order. But like there's one or two places where like you have to have one or even two characters in your party for a special event to actually take place. And so there's some obtuse stuff there where they really aren't giving you hints. And maybe you could figure it out by sort of logic if you thought about it really hard. Like, well, these two characters have a relationship together, and this location is kind of important because that's where they used to live. So maybe if I put these two in my party, then this special event will happen. And there's only one or two occasions of that, but it's kind of annoying. It's a bit obtuse. So I enjoy the battle system. I'm enjoying the characters, and the translation's fun. I mean, it's punchy, as I guess other people have said on Retronauts when they were talking about that. I find that it's like, who's talking right now sometimes is sort of the feeling I'm getting, because there are parts where you could have anyone in your party especially the second half of the game. And so there's kind of stock text that it's interesting, it's good, but it isn't any one character talking. So it's just like quotation marks. And it's like, who's talking here?
It doesn't have a sort of distinctive voice to it, I guess.
Well, I don't know. It's good stuff, and it's pretty well written. So highly recommended for $8. You really can't go wrong. The only thing I thought was really clunky was the menu system, which Chrono Trigger basically lifted that. I mean, it's the same menu system and it has its quirks. And so it's a little difficult sometimes to tell what you're doing in the menu. There's a lot of perusing, and even when you're battling, you have to kind of adjust to how it shows you who's fighting, because it's not immediately obvious. But overall, excellent game. Very, very satisfied with it. The other game I wanted to talk about was Gargoyle's Quest, which was recently released for the 3DS Virtual Console. It seems like all I play these days are Virtual Console games, but maybe that just speaks to my taste.
I can relate to that in large measure.
It's not even a slight to Nintendo per se, because I'm not really playing PS3 games either. So,
oh, yeah.
But yeah, Gargoyle's Quest is a game that I'd heard good things about, but I didn't really know anything about. I'd almost purchased this particular game from a used game store, but I thought it was overpriced. And so I'm glad to now be able to get it for $4. And I was going in there expecting, okay, well, you know, I'm playing this RPG and I'm going to get a nice action game here. And first thing I'm greeted to at the start of the game is a very Dragon Quest. Walking around in a room. So it's an interesting game. It actually reminds me a little bit of Zelda 2 in that it's a mixture of RPG and action elements where you go around in an overworld, but then the battles actually take place in a side-scrolling environment. It feels a little clunky. I think it has a little bit of Simon's Quest controls going on.
Oh no,
it's not that
I don't think it's anywhere near that bad. I mean, controls wise all the rest of the game is
that is not a phrase I want to hear.
No, the jumping mechanic is actually fine because you can actually hover and you can stick to walls, but it's kind of the two hits and you're dead kind of thing, and some of the hit detection is very cruel in my opinion.
Well, there's a few things that first of all, you do have some of what I could kind of refer to, even though it came later, Metroid 2 sort of syndrome,
yes,
which applies to quite a few Game Boy games, which is when you have these big, chunky, relatively detailed sprites in a Game Boy game, that's nice, you know, and it certainly looks a lot more striking than something like Super Mario Land. But the problem is that your play area ends up being really quite cramped. Yeah. And so, you know, things could kind of come and get you and you haven't got much time to react.
Or get you from off screen, as is the case with some games.
Yeah, well, the game is pretty slow paced, but there are, even early in the game, there are jumps where I wouldn't say it's a jump of faith, but it's like you got to really clear these spikes and you're not quite sure where it ends because you can't quite see to the other side. It's just a difficult game. I mean, I really haven't been able to get very far in it.
Well, I mean, I've managed to finish it now because, I mean, it's short. Okay. That's something I've always heard about it, is that it's short. Even though it does have these overheads, more the sort of trappings of an RPG component than an actual one.
Okay.
It's just filling time, the way I look at it. I mean, there's very limited sort of meaningful exploration in those bits. But you do get random battles that are fairly infrequent, so they're not too annoying. Where it's just that you're trying to go from one part of the landscape to the other, and then, you know, you have to just fight one or two enemies in a little side-on arena. They're not too bothersome or anything. And it is possible, and so I did this once or twice when it was quite difficult, to say, right, I'm going to judiciously employ the restore point functionality here. You know, because you might have a situation where, you know, the actual action level is really quite hard.
Yeah, that's what I run into.
And you're going to have, you know, a few lives at that. And then the problem is, you run out of lives, and then it's like, okay, well, where it respawns you is back in a town, and then you've got to do a few things and fight a few random battles before you get back to the action level that you were stuck on. And, you know, when you're trying to continually chip away until you get good enough to beat the level, that time that you have to do just to get back to where you were is really quite irksome. So restore point solves it. Just save it when you arrive at the beginning of the action level, and bang, once you run out of lives, you could just essentially skip just that bit of, you know, exploration, which really, I think, was mostly padding for what is a short game at the time. And so you can eliminate that. And that, I think that definitely sped up my progression through the game, but didn't meaningfully lower the challenge, because it doesn't affect how difficult those action stages are. It just affects how long you take to get to them.
So, Greg, do you level up? I didn't notice if you really... there are levels to your equipment and statistics, but do you actually level up due to experience points?
Yeah, it doesn't work like a typical accumulation experience. What will happen is, like, you'll either beat a level or like, after beating a level, talk to a certain character or something, and they'll give you an item, and then that will correspond to having better life bar. You know, they say, oh, I give you the suit of armor, so your life bar gets longer.
Yeah.
Or they give you, like, a special candle so that your ability...
You can burn bushes.
No, it's not that complex. It's just like you just get better core abilities. Like, I mean, the two main things are how high you can jump and then how long you can hover for. And, you know, I mean, eventually you can hover indefinitely right at the end of the game. You could just do it. But there's a few different increments with how long you can hover for. And that's the character becomes more powerful, but it's in a very sort of obvious way for the most part, where he just jumps higher, he just hovers longer. Yeah. But it does have a meaningful difference in the level design, from the point of view that, you know, early on, it's kept in mind that, well, okay, you know, you've got to touch base on a surface every so often to kind of refill that a hover gauge.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, later on, it knows you don't have to do that. So it becomes a lot more about traversing big distances while avoiding like enemies or avoiding spikes or this kind of stuff. So the level design does change, you know, significantly in that way. And so it's short, so you wouldn't expect anything less, really. But it's dynamic enough in that way.
Okay, that's good.
And then some of the other things about it, you do get some sort of meaningful upgrades to your sort of your weapon, you know, where you just spits out whatever that is.
I think it's supposed to be fire.
You get one that looks like a sort of boomerang that breaks blocks that you would be impeding your progress, which is not too meaningful. But the best one by far is when you spit out this, like, what looks like a sort of gooey ball. And if you put that onto spikes that are lining a wall, then it creates a platform that you can cling to. And then you could sort of essentially wall jump on spikes by creating your own safe zones. So that's a cool little wrinkle in the gameplay as well that I enjoy sort of using. And I mean, we talked last time about how sort of the wall clinging might remind you of Mega Man X. And when I talked about Mega Man X a few months ago now, I mentioned that, you know, some of the more vertical sections of that game were not my favorite parts of it. So you might think, well, did you enjoy this, considering that's a way bigger part of the game, essentially? But actually, I think the fact that you can hover changes it significantly. Yeah. It just made that whole dynamic of, like, clinging to walls and traversing these sheer faces of and all that kind of stuff, it just made it work for me. I didn't have a problem with that. So I enjoyed the challenge. I enjoyed the precision of the platforming and stuff at times. Oh, the only thing is, it just... Yeah, some of these elements, like the exploration, all that, it does show its age. And then there is one particular sort of, you couldn't really call it a glitch. It's just like a perverse structure of a boss where you're fighting it as normal, and then what'll happen is a lot of the time, you know, you're just waiting for it to sort of come level with you so you can shoot at it. And then when it shoots at you, you jump up, hover away to safety, rinse and repeat, right? Mm-hmm. But what happens is when you kill the boss, it sort of does this little fanfare, and so everything freezes. But then once it unfreezes, the bullet is still there and then comes and gets you.
You saw that in a bunch of old games.
It's like, yeah, exactly. It's something that just happened in old games. So it's like, if that had been just running real time, I would have avoided it easily. But because it freezes and then unfreezes, it gets me. And so the boss is dead, I die, back to the start. You know, this is the kind of stuff that would only have happened in the late 80s, early 90s kind of phase of games. So, you know, for some people who've never experienced that kind of, or seldom experienced, it might be really annoying, but for me it was kind of funny, but the first time anyway. So I got through those kinds of stuff and really enjoyed it. It's a very fun little addition to the Virtual Console lineup. You know, so I'd recommend a lot of people, you know, as long as they're up for the challenge, give it a look. I know Johnny's been playing it. I think he's finished it as well, and he enjoyed it a lot. So, I mean, perhaps he'll talk about that on a future episode as well, but well worth a look. And now, the only other thing I really have for new business this week, not a lot, is just that I've been pressing on with Rhythm Heaven. I've got all the medals now, and I'm sort of starting to make a run at getting all the perfects. So it's not easy, you know, but it just strikes me as being a lot more doable than it was on the DS one, because the thing with the DS one is just like, obviously with going for a perfect, you can't make a single mistake. And there was always, but the way I played it anyway, very often I would just have like an input error, you know, with the touchscreen. So I might have the song down, I might have the rhythm down and everything, but I would just make a mistake, and, you know, that it just didn't seem viable to me to get all the perfects in that game. But with this one, I think I could do it, so I'm going for it. I've got quite a few already. And there are some cool unlockables. I've already got, like, there's four songs from the GBA game that you can unlock for getting the excellent medals or whatever, you know, which are kind of weird because you need to have got a medal on a lot of songs to unlock them, but they're actually some of the more basic songs from the GBA ones. So it's kind of a big backward step in terms of how difficult it is to pull off. But it'd be nice for those to make their way into the Western release of Rhythm Heaven for Wii when it happens, because, of course, you know, that'll be the first time they've been seen by the audience outside of Japan. So you've got like the ghost one and the calligraphy one and a couple of others, you know, so it's just fun, and they sound a little cleaner than before. I guess they probably just up the quality of the synth or whatever, but I'm going to keep playing it. I'm absolutely committed to try and get those perfects one day. And so now we move on to James to wrap us up for new business.
Yeah. So I have something that's not related to anything we've discussed today to talk about.
Is it related to anything that anyone has ever discussed?
Well,
possibly.
Is it related to like the Hanukkah song or like the musical?
No.
I mean, what is this a reference to, this game?
So what I have is the Atlas-published downloadable game Rock of Ages, which is a game about a rock.
Do you have it just because it's published by Atlas?
So I actually wanted to talk about why I got this, and TYP might remember this. So every year at E3, Atlas rents out the back card of the badges, and Nintendo rents out the lanyard.
Right.
So 2 years ago, so not even last year, 2 years ago, Atlas had the back card for a game called Rock of Ages. I just remember the back card looking kind of weird and not paying it much mind, mostly because I was like, oh my god, I'm at E3, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, it's the first one.
So yesterday when I boot up my, usually, because I get up in the morning and I usually watch something on Netflix, and I booted up the Xbox, and in the little window for the new games that came out that Thursday, or that Wednesday, was this game called Rock of Ages, and it clicked, and I'm like, didn't that game come out like 2 years ago? What the hell is going on here? So I go in there, and I bring it up, and I just say, all right, screw it, let's just download the demo. Let's go for it. Here's how I've described this game. At one point, I said it's like Odama and the Louvre had a freak baby, and it's awesome.
It's funny, actually. I read a review for this Rock of Ages the other day, and it had I think it's a staggering tagline that describes it somewhat, which says, blends world history with bowling to joyfully idiotic effect.
Yes. So,
you would go along with that description.
Yes.
That does sound like Odama.
Here's the game in a nutshell. It's very loosely based on the story of Sisyphus. So okay. For those of you who haven't studied your Greek mythology, Sisyphus is a character in Greek mythology who, the long and the short of it is tasked with rolling a large stone ball to the top of a hill, which of course it rolls down the other side once it gets it up there. So this will go on forever, hence the term Sisyphean task, which is a task you can never complete, essentially. Sisyphus gets tired of rolling this ball up this hill only to have it come back down, and proceeds to instead use the ball to smash the walls of the underworld and escape, and in the process crushes Hades with said ball. So here's how I describe the game to someone. The art style is very reminiscent of the animated sequences from episodes of Monty Python.
Yeah, I've heard that. Terry Gilliam-esque.
Yeah, it's very clearly borrowing from this. So for example, there's a section where your opponent is Charlemagne. So it's Charlemagne removed from Tapestry, whose name is escaping me at the moment. It's literally just him extracted from this famous Tapestry with him on it. And he's very crudely animated where his legs move like a paper puppet. He's two-dimensional because he's flat. And then you roll him over with a giant stone ball, and he screams like a little girl. But the idea of the game is it's kind of Marble Madness-y. You're on this stage that banks around as it slowly slopes downhill. There are holes you have to jump over. Hmm. And your objective is to get to the bottom as fast as you can, with as much speed as you can, and slam into these gates that are protecting the historical opponent you're facing. All the while, they're building obstacles, tower defense style obstacles, to get in your way. So destroying them gets you money, but damages your stone ball, and the more damage it takes, the less damage it will do at the bottom. At the same time, you're putting up defenses on an identical path, and your opponent is rolling a ball at your end. So basically the goal is to knock down the tower door before he knocks down yours.
This sounds pretty convoluted.
So you get the ball to the bottom, you hit the wall, then you have time because your ball has to be rebuilt by your craftsman. So you can spend that time building your towers. And
is that where the money goes, is building towers and all this kind of stuff?
It's all very kinetic. There's always something going on, and you're watching in the top corner your opponent roll ever increasingly closer to your gate, going, please don't get there, please don't get there, and slamming into the wall and going, okay, how much damage did he do?
Okay, so you have to repeatedly smash.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not like a get to the goal and the level's over. It's an attack.
However many hits it takes to get through the wall. Generally speaking, it's about three. I've had some go as long as four. But still relatively early in the game. But the speed at which you hit the wall will determine how much damage you do, as well as the current structural integrity of your stone ball. But there's something about seeing, so to give you kind of an idea of how irreverent the humor is in this game, one of the stages is Thermopylae. And it starts with a Greek figure from a pot, you know, the blacked out artwork on that they did on their pottery, with the number 1 just floating over his head, walking out of a door. And he walks past 2, 3, 4, 5, and the numbers start to go up quickly as there's more people he's passing. And you realize at some point, oh God, there's 300 of them. And he gets to the front, and Sisyphus is just standing there staring at him. And you get the, this is Sparta, the slowdown, and then the kick into the hole, and then realize that as the screen pans over, the hole was only about a foot wide, and Sisyphus has just landed on the other side and is waving at him. He then runs off and gets his own giant stone ball, and you proceed to go to battle. I mean, that's the kind of weird humor this game employs.
I think most people looked at something like Odama, which was pinball RTS, rather than this is sort of Marble Madness RTS.
Marble Madness Tower Defense, yes.
But yeah, and then so you know what this needs is Python-esque humor. If it had that, it yes. would be perfect. And so apparently it took several years, but they got there.
So the best part about this game, though, and it never gets old, is when you're facing some historical figure, so like Justinian. So, like, all the little people that were running around trying to escape from the ball were all extracted from works of Byzantine art, so you've got to flatten them as you roll over them.
So all the levels have a very distinct feel to them aesthetically, but what about the actual variety in what you do?
One stage, for example, is just a straight ramp down. There's no turns, there's no banks, and it gets going really fast, and the obstacles become... Like, don't even bother putting any projectile obstacles there because they're not going to do anything. You're just going to go shoot past them like a rocket. But you put barriers in the way and they get deflected off way into the side and get shot off the side of the screen because inertia hits and you get flung out of there with the game's kind of janky physics. But you get to the bottom and it's just like straight onto the gate and you just slam into it and do so much damage. And it's basically at this point you're just racing the AI down the bottom of the hill. And whatever you can do to slow him down in the hopes you'll get there faster than him is the entire premise of the level. Or another one, the level set in Venice during the Renaissance. They set it in Venice, so it's full of canals. And canals slow you down. You roll very slowly in the water. So you're basically island hopping as you jump from island to island so you don't get slowed down. You could try to beat the AI to the bottom. There's a lot of like seeing... Hey, you know, it sort of has this sharp turn and continues that way. I bet I could jump over that whole section of level by jumping off this cliff to that one. And then realizing, oh, I wasn't going fast enough to make it. Oh, well. As you get further into the game, you also unlock more things you can use to defend. One of them was Leonardo's flying machine, which drops stuff on the enemy. One of them is a mastodon with like a giant stone tower on its back, kind of like the Oliphants from Lord of the Rings. That just grabs things with its tusk and flings them.
It sounds like a kind of highbrow, lowbrow kind of game, if you know what I mean. Like, there's all these kind of historic cultural references are not, you know, things that everyone's going to get, but at the same time, it's got a sort of stupid fun element to it.
I mean, it's so absurd. It's wonderfully weird, and the gameplay is actually kind of fun.
It's the kind of thing I might look into.
There should be a demo on the PSN too, so...
I'll have a look, see if it's up on the, you know, obviously the European version is not always synchronized, but I'll keep an eye out. That's going to do it for new business. So after we come back, we are going to be tackling a whole lot of your listener mail. We've picked out quite a few, haven't been covered before, so hopefully if you've been waiting for your letter to be answered, it will be imminently. See you after the break.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with our annual review of Madden for Wii, Madden NFL 12 by Neil Ronahan, who's been reviewing these games for us for quite a while now. But he does note that Madden is always brighter the year after the Packers win the Super Bowl, and Neil, of course, being a Green Bay fan. I would like to add to that that life itself is always brighter after a season in which the Patriots fail to win a playoff game.
There you go. Not bitter at all. Speaking of licensed sports games, so this isn't a sport. We have a review of Wii NASCAR 2011, excuse me, The Game, by Jared Rosenberg. It's not good, and in fact, a salient quote to describe that it's not good, the white flag is up, and I don't care.
So it's called, has a subtitle of the game because it's based on the movie, right?
No, based on The Race. NASCAR 2011, The Race, the game. We also have a preview of another driving game for the 3DS this time, Driver Renegade by Nate Andrews. Ubisoft sandbox driving game. It's coming to 3DS in September. It's Driver, and he's a renegade.
Okay, well, we also have a blog entry by Aaron on what role do the goddesses play. He deciphers the Skyward Sword box art. We also have an Extra Life article in which Scott Thompson writes about why kind of a third-party classic, Tiny Toon's Adventures Buster Bust Loose, that's hard to say, Buster Bust Loose, is not such a great game. I know Pedro loves that game. Go check that out, and then probably go check out Pedro's response that Shirley's in TalkBack.
We round out this week's Now Playing with a couple of articles. So first of all, we have JP's blog on the SNES from an outsider's perspective. JP actually isn't fond of Super Mario World and A Link to the Past, and you'll have to read the blog to find out why. My thought was the official explanation was demonic possession or something, but apparently it isn't.
There is evidence to corroborate such a claim.
And also we have the aforementioned Pedro Hernandez with an editorial on how the Super Nintendo changed his view on video games altogether. Apparently he was very picky as a child, but the Super Nintendo fixed that. So
is that fixed?
So definitely read about how that experience went for him. And of course, we have all the latest news. Far more coverage will be going up after we've recorded this, so stay tuned to NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the second part of the show. We're now going to get to your listener mail. We have rather a lot of it, obviously, because we didn't do last week with the Killer 7 retroactive, so I wanted to get as much as possible this week, as I'm not sure what we're going to be able to manage in that regard next week as well. But still, we're always going to need more of your letters, so be sure to send them to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com with all your questions, comments, suggestions, and whatnot. And with that, we're going to begin. Now, as you might expect, given that we've been talking about the 3DS a lot lately with the price cut and all that sort of thing, we've got quite a few emails about new 3DS owners and their experiences, so I'm going to kick off with a trio of those. TYP, you have the first.
All right, well, Jay in Tampa writes, I just wanted to share a 3DS experience that I had this morning. Every day, I take my little girl, who is now 8 months old, to daycare. Today, the teacher who watches the babies noticed my hat with the word player on it above an NES controller. So she asked me if I have a DS 3. I said I get what she means. She then said her kids have 10 free games coming to them because of the price drop, and that she would like my help in getting the games in case they can't figure it out. I was blown away that this woman not only knew about the 3DS, but that she knew about the price drop and the Ambassador games. She even mentioned them coming out in September and that there would be 10 more coming out later in the year. She says that the Best Buy also gave her the price difference since she had purchased the system shortly before the cut. Well, I guess I have one comment that's very trivial. I have this very same hat. I actually don't wear it because... because I purchased it at the NOA headquarters, and on the trip back, it must have gotten jostled around a lot in the suitcase, and the bill got very frayed, so it's kind of not really usable. But I hang it up on the wall, so it's sort of decorative now.
Well, it's interesting, of course. First of all, I wanted to mention about this particular story. There is a part where he says, well, she was asking in case she needed some help.
Yes, she does.
Getting these free games. Yeah, well, as you could tell from our discussion
she will.
At the front,
yes.
That was a prudent question to ask, because in that part, she might be aware of these games and whatnot, but that part of it might be a bit less intuitive, shall we say. But I would imagine, just on the issue, you know, Best Buy is mentioned there, that the retailers are probably a big source of information in this kind of stuff. They're probably, you know, if they're doing things like offering people the difference or whatever, then right, they're probably letting them know, well, don't regret buying it with us now, because actually you're going to get some free games out of it and stuff. So that would be one conduit of information that Nintendo has that's outside of, you know, people reading our website or, you know, similar ones. So now we'll move on to the next one. This is Kyle in Bear, Delaware.
Bear!
And he said, I wanted to bring you my experience as a 3DS owner of about 1.5 weeks. I purchased my 3DS on eBay a few days after the price drop announcement, and I got it for $200. I've bought some downloadable games, including playing some Game Boy titles for the first time. The problem came when I wanted to buy some contemporary software. There wasn't any. I ended up buying Dragon Quest IV for cheap and reluctantly dropped $40 on Ocarina 3D. After spending some time with it, the 3DS is my favourite DS out of the ones I've used. There's a lot to like, especially for the current price, which I think will do wonders for hardware sales, but there's just not enough content yet. After playing DQ4 for 12 hours, the 3DS could really use with some kind of popular, addictive RPG. If only Nintendo could release something like that.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, one thing I thought when I read this was... It's never been something that Nintendo's done before, but you know, could they regret maybe how they handled like putting Pokemon Black and White out so that, you know, it was exclusive to the DS and they didn't have like a 3DS version that came a bit after or something, you know, that would have been a bit tighter to the launch. So yes, it probably would have been trivially enhanced, but there's plenty of games that probably fit into that category. I mean, the Devil Survivor Overclock that's just come out is almost exclusively 2D because it
was a DS game.
It was designed for a DS game that was primarily on the touchscreen, so you would have to completely change everything to have like consistent 3D usage and stuff. So I mean, Pokemon wouldn't have had to be that limited, but that is the sort of thing that it could have used with right now, you know, something that people would have that they would feel is kind of value for money. I think that's one of the problems, is that, you know, 3DS ushered in a kind of a new era of retail pricing for portable software, but at the same time what you're getting is a lot of smaller experiences that a lot of people are finding kind of difficult to justify paying that high price for.
The fact that Cubic Ninja at one moment ever cost $40 is insulting. Insulting to people everywhere.
Well, it's sad. I mean, I the only two 3DS games I own that are 3DS card games is Pilot Wings, which I bought at launch, and the Steel Diver game, which I barely played because I don't like, that I got for $5 due to an Amazon coupon. And it really is sad that there aren't any other games out there. I mean, I use my 3DS to play Radiant Historia. So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of in the same boat here as Kyle. It's like, you know, I like 3DS. I'm really enjoying Virtual Console stuff and now the Ambassador stuff. But there really isn't a whole lot of meaty stuff out there. You know, there aren't any Mario and Luigi's out there yet.
Yeah, now that's a good point because, I mean, Mario and Luigi, Partners in Time, most people might not rate it as their favourite in that series, but it's a very good game. And that was out, you know, the sort of the second holiday season for DS, I suppose. But still, it's a kind of slot that, you know, Paper Mario, which is coming for 3DS, would have fit into quite nicely, but they haven't been able to make it for this. And maybe it'd be too crowded with Mario Kart and Super Mario 3D Land anyway.
Oh, yeah. I think they're resolving this issue soon.
But it's still a little disappointing that it's taken, you know, obviously it's a subject we talked about plenty of times with the software planning, but it does seem like the specific genre type, you know, putting down the marker with an RPG type experience of some sort would have been good to happen within the first 9 months.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll move on to the last of our 3DS emails. And James, you've got this one.
Chris from Minneapolis writes, "Hey guys, I picked up a 3DS when the price dropped, and I have to say I like it a lot. It's been fun to show people pics taken with a 3D camera. I've also been playing old DS games on it and like the controls. And the idea of downloadable games from the NES, Game Boy, and GBA means this should be the ultimate handheld. However, I have no idea why there aren't more new, original, downloadable 3DS games. Why isn't there a downloadable 3DS Picross game? You could do the game and then offer DLC for a long time. I know just about every member of NWR would pay like $2 for 100 3DS Picross puzzles downloaded to the system."
It's an interesting point that Chris raises here because, of course, there is a Picross eShop game that's available exclusively in Japan as of now. It came out in July, I think it was the end of July, maybe the beginning of August, but you know, not so long ago. But equally, it's a Picross game. You would have thought it's the kind of thing that could easily have already been brought.
Well, it's difficult to translate Picross.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it could easily have already been brought to America and Europe as well. So I'm not really sure why things like that, you know, there's a number of, actually, I think Japan has quite a few more original games that have already come out in that sort of, not, it's not called 3DSware, but let's just refer to it as that, sort of a bit of shorthand.
Colloquially.
Yeah, and they've got that. I think it's Picture Lives is coming out next week, which it's coming out next week in Japan, which I know is a favorite of James.
No!
He's a big star of the E3 podcast. If you
remember
those, James was sort of speechless almost what he'd seen with that. But yeah, I mean, I think the real issue here is just that Nintendo, again, is not really leading from the front on these games. Yeah. They did it with DSiWare, they did it with WiiWare, they've never led from the front of it. They've had some cool things that they've published, like the art style games or Fluidity, or there are quite a few examples, but they're not out in front of it, and they're not there with their big brand. So yeah. I agree, there should be a lot more. I think there's a bigger space for it now because the retail games are $40. I think there's a healthy intermediate ground there, you know, for $12 or something, where you could have your robust games that are downloadable.
But, you know, if I'm going to spend $12, I want something commensurate with an Xbox Live Arcade game.
Why shouldn't we get those? I mean,
those games are 500 megabytes.
Well, true. I mean, in that sense, but I mean, obviously, you're not talking about HD assets or anything on that.
True, but they're still much bigger than anything. They're much bigger than Let's 3D Golf.
Well, but it has been confirmed that you have not got the same kind of size restraints on the eShop. That we do know. That, I mean, I'm not saying they're going to be as big as XBLA games, obviously, but it's not as ridiculously restrictive as what we've had in the past. We know that. And we do have a couple of promising Western games. Mighty Switch Force, that's, you know, the Way Forward game we've mentioned before. There was a trailer, 3D trailer, that just went up on the European eShop. Looks very cool. I mean, it doesn't, obviously, because it's one of those fuzzy kind of videos on the eShop, it doesn't really convey how crisp that sprite work is going to look in reality. But the way they're using the layers and the parallax, that looks cool. And yeah, I think Way Forward, they've demonstrated they work this niche really well already. And then there's the Renegade Kid game, Mutant Muds, as well. It's not so far off. So, you know, there's stuff coming. It's just, you know, again, Nintendo is not pushing it, so that it seems like, as is perhaps natural with Nintendo platforms, if Nintendo doesn't push something hard, everyone else is just kind of waiting for them to do it.
Yeah, I think that'll be true of downloadable content for retail games too. Nintendo still has not demonstrated any real interest in doing that.
Yeah, they've talked a little bit about, you know, they're going to have maybe a different approach to that on Wii U, and that they're, you know, it's going to happen on 3DS and all that, but they're still not really leading on it very strongly.
Sure. Well, yeah, and if Nintendo is not, you know, using DLC a lot, then they're not going to feel compelled to create an infrastructure and tools to make DLC seamless.
I mean, DLC in Wii wasn't terrible. I mean, My Life as a King had functional DLC interface. Yeah. But some games had much less functional interfaces. So I think it was more that if you were good, you could have a good interface. But there wasn't like a built-in interface API.
Yeah. The other thing I think we need to mention here is that, you know, we're talking about this in the context of downloadable games and how there aren't many essentially third-party downloadable games, but there aren't many third-party games, period, for 3DS right now.
Well, unless you count Ubisoft, because there's plenty of those.
Yes, there's plenty of crummy Ubisoft titles, and a few good ones,
too.
It's
a third of the DS library.
I mean, that kind of goes to everything. You know, it seems like now there's been a lot of delays, and presumably there's a lot of projects that we don't know about that are maybe a bit in limbo, because people have become less convinced about what kind of viable marketplace is going to be going forward. So it may well be that, you know, as the retail software picks up, if this price cut is successful, we will see the eShop become more prominent as well. I mean, that you would expect that if the system proves itself in the future. Well, right, we're going to move on to the rest of our listener mail here. We've got plenty. So first of all, Travis from Los Angeles with a question for me. So TYP, if you could read that, please.
Yes, Greg, I am looking into getting a Sin and Punishment title, but I'm having a hard time deciding on which one to get. The low pricing of Star Successor, less than $20 on Amazon, is limiting frugality as a factor in this decision. Greg, As the resident Sin and Punishment expert, can you please shed some light on which game in the series is the best entry point?
Yeah, I mean, for me, given that you've said about the price there, Travis, I would say go for the Wii One Star Successor, because it's a bit like what we talked about with Star Fox during the Super Nintendo 20 discussion we had a few weeks ago. The Wii version has significantly more intuitive and just effective controls. And so I don't think there's a difficulty disparity that exists between Super Nintendo Star Fox and N64 Star Fox, between Wii Sin and Punishment and N64 Sin and Punishment. They're both pretty hard. But I think you'll just be able to get to grips with the challenge more easily because you won't feel like you're kind of fighting the controls. You know what I mean? N64, it's got more limited movement. You can't just float around and all that. And you know, you have to use an analog stick and the C buttons originally on the, you know, on the N64 controller and all that. So that is not as accessible. The Wii one is still not exactly the most accessible of games. You know, it is a pretty damn hardcore.
Yeah.
Action shooting game, but of the two, I think it's similar to Star Fox again. Start with the one that came later, and then if you enjoy it and you get on with it and you enjoy the challenge, maybe you can actually graduate up to the older one, which is even more sort of not for the faint-hearted.
Sadistic.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to quibble with that characterization of it. All right, so we now move on to our next letter. This is from Brandon, and he writes, I'm in my sophomore year of college, and I've decided to get an apartment of my own, meaning no more mooching off my roommate's Wii. The question is, should I buy a Wii now or wait for the Wii U launch?
So I guess I have a question for Brandon. So what do you want the Wii for? Do you want it for games you haven't played yet? Or is it to get access to a library you're familiar with and want to own yourself? Because if it's the latter, go ahead and buy it. I mean, if you want access to whatever, Brawl or Boomblox or some of these other games, just so you can play them with your friends, and go for it. I mean, it's certainly worth it because we use whatever, a year out, and if you want to play those games now, play
them. Yeah, I mean, we don't know. I mean, that's the thing. It's difficult to answer from the point of view. We don't know how much longer you'll be waiting exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, go for a used one if you're worried about the price. I'm sure you can get a used one for very cheap.
Oh yeah, they're
cheap. Yeah, there's probably going to be some good deals coming up around the holiday season and stuff as well. I would have thought in the States,
especially if that new model of Wii actually does make it to the US at some point.
Yeah, the value bundle. It's the family bundle that's in Europe.
But if you really want a Wii for other games that are coming out, like if you say, well, I've already played all my friends' games and I'm waiting for, say, Skyward Sword, I don't know.
Well, that's the question. How much do you care about Skyward Sword? I mean, for some people, the new Zelda game, you know, if it was a question of literally, you know, if I want to play this, I might have to wait a whole year later. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to wait for the Wii U launch, for instance, it could be a year after Zelda comes out. That might be a long time to wait for the new Zelda game if you're a big fan of the series.
Well, and to be honest, you could probably borrow your friend's Wii by that amount of time.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That sort of thing is difficult to say whether you have what kind of options you've got.
I mean, if that's the reason why you'd be buying it, consider maybe asking if you could borrow first.
I don't know where Brandon lives, but if he lives in Europe, there's also, of course, two RPGs that just came out that he probably has not had time to play yet. And
well, one's out. One's coming later.
One's out. One's coming out. Pardon me. Stricken from the record.
Yes.
my point being, I mean, there are some games coming out still that are high profile, especially if you're living in Europe.
Like Fortune Street.
The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, when the Wii U launch, there'll be plenty of systems available. You don't have to worry about going in lines or anything. It'll be really easy.
Thanks, Johnny. I do think, also taking into consideration what the depth of the library your roommate had, because I know my Wii library is incomplete with the games I wanted to play, but it's still far in excess of anyone else's library I've ever seen in person. And
yeah,
there are a lot of games on this system that the average consumer did not purchase that are worth playing. And if you missed those, you could easily take yourself to Wii U on those games.
Yeah, if he was like just relying on his roommate sort of tasting games, there might be a whole other sort of section of games on Wii that you could explore.
Yeah, I would say if you don't own at least 20 Wii games, you have at least a handful of glaring omissions.
I have some glaring omissions then, I think.
I have some glaring omissions and I own well more than 20.
Yeah, it is, whatever else you say about it, it's a tremendously diverse
yes.
library that it has. Not necessarily deep in every genre.
No.
But it does have the breadth there, and usually some really sort of standout ones in each sort of category.
I have Endless Ocean next to Rayman next to Punch-Out. I mean...
it's been great for that. It's sort of similar to the DS in that way, but I certainly appreciate that aspect of this particular life cycle for Nintendo. We'll now move on to the next letter, and James, you've got this one.
Massimo writes, "In my opinion, the main feature and selling point of Nintendo's new console will be the possibility to play full traditional console games solely on the controller screen. The interaction with the television screen will eventually be relegated just to asymmetric multiplayer and the introduction of marginal but convenient features. Nintendo has always been a Japan-centric company, and I see this controller as a response to the crisis of the traditional home console in Japan, where many gamers play mostly handhelds at home just because it's more convenient and doesn't require taking away the TV screen from their family or partners. I think the concept behind Wii U is brilliant, but the console could be either a great success or a great failure. In Japan, its success could be undermined by the fact that the upcoming Vita, a quote, full handheld system, doesn't seem far behind Wii U technologically. In America and Europe, tablets could be Nintendo's main competitors. Do you think Wii U stands a chance against Apple and Sony?"
Yes, it raises a number of interesting issues for me. I mean, the whole issue being able to switch, playing it on the TV screen, you know, with the controller having a separate display, and then, you know, just to playing it on the controller if someone else wants to use the TV or whatever. I guess that may be more of an appealing kind of feature in Japan.
Yeah,
you know, if you've
I don't
got
care about it.
Small apartments or whatever, they haven't got multiple rooms with multiple TVs and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's worth mentioning, if you look at the thrust of Nintendo's approach on Wii, more so as the system's gone on, it's been about local multiplayer. It's been about games that everyone can enjoy around the same TV screen. And I think that is a response to what Massimo's talking about, in a sense, where it's like, well, let's not have a game that only one person can play and it kind of alienates everyone else. Let's have a game that the whole household can enjoy. But then, of course, this kind of solves the same problem in the complete opposite way. So it's not a game that everyone will enjoy looking at, but that I can just play it without affecting everyone else. So I can see that part of the appeal in Japan, especially. Now, in terms of how it would affect me personally, yes, it's not such a big deal, admittedly. But I have been giving some thought to this recently, with Xenoblade coming out, and I haven't got it yet. I've got it on order, so waiting for it to get restocked here. But I was thinking, you know, that particular kind of game, I would see the merit in sort of switching between the two play modes. Because on the one hand, you know, there'd be some times where, you know, if I was going into like a new area of the game or was doing a boss battle or this, that, and the other, I'd want it on the big TV. I'd want it with the sound set up and have it up loud and all that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, if I'm in the middle of doing, you know, a bunch of side quests or something, it might be more convenient for me to just have that in the sort of, you know, quasi-portable kind of sense around the house and just kind of more absent-mindedly play it, maybe while looking at something else or this kind of stuff. So for those kind of long format games that you can kind of play into different gears, I think it does have a utility that is separate from just, oh, well, you know, someone else is asking for the TV back.
That's a good point.
I mean, you could also say that you're asking for the TV back, too. I mean, you could say... Well,
yeah, because you want to put a baseball game on there or something.
Yeah, and I'm busy grinding right now, so I'll turn on something mindless and half watch that, half grind.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. I mean, I do think that is a useful feature, and I think people maybe in the States who don't play their portables a lot at home, maybe they'll discover the kind of the joy of multitasking with games more with the Wii U, giving them that option.
I will say playing Super Mario Brothers U on the screen was not an enjoyable experience.
Now, in terms of how it's going to compete with some of these different threats that it has to work, I mean, of course, Vita has the added thing. I mean, it is, you know, in itself, it's a powerful device. It's going to play console-like experiences on it. But it interacts with the PS3, or it certainly could, Sony have already kind of said this, you know, in much the same way as the Wii U controller can interact with the base hardware. So there's definitely some capacity for Sony to get this functionality going. But the thing is, you've got to have the two devices. It's still a lot more
expensive.
Exactly. Right.
It's the same problem that Nintendo ran into in the GameCube era, where you had to have a GameCube and a Game Boy Advance. You don't have to have a cable, but there's still an extra barrier. And you know, the big thing about Wii U is that the controller comes with the system. So it is an inherent part. It's there. It's not a splintered user base or anything. So developers can feel confident that they can make use of the tablet and make use of it in clever ways, not just as a second screen or an alternate screen.
It's so, not a single tuner.
And I kind of disagree with the prediction that the controller will be relegated to a screen while you're not using the main TV, because I think there's a lot that can be done just in terms of cleaning up interfaces. I mean, you saw a lot of this on DS where like in Chrono Trigger, when they ported it, they brought all the menu stuff to the bottom screen. And
I like that kind of stuff, but do you think that falls strictly under the, as Massimo puts it, marginal but convenient? You know, it's nice, but it's not really that important.
I think that there's some interesting, you know, like you were discussing in prior episodes about kind of like scan visor type modes, things where it isn't just convenient, it actually adds not having to push pause or pull up a separate menu or a separate screen to do something.
Well, I mean, I do think in certain cases, some of these things that you would say are conveniences, they might go beyond the realm of marginal for me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, maybe they're still not going to be huge deals, but, you know, say for it's something that's been talked about quite a lot on this show. For instance, so Borderlands was all like loot, you know, like you get it, you have to check what's better. If you could streamline that down so it's just happening on your controller and it's just happening a lot quicker and all that, I mean, as Johnny kind of mentioned when he was like, how many minutes would that shave off your playtime? You know, these sort of lost minutes where you're just sort of doing this almost a busy work of comparing things. Yes, it is just merely a convenience, but that could add up to quite a lot over, you know, the life of an extensive kind of experience game. And then, I mean, in terms of how it's going to change gameplay, I mean, this also goes to the question of how it's going to compete with everything else. It's going to have Nintendo's top developers on it. You know, I'm expecting them to come up with some stuff that's pretty damn clever.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I don't know that we've necessarily seen it yet with the concepts. You know, a lot of them are similar to things we've seen before in this kind of area, like the Pac-Man versus style chase me or whatever, you know. But I do think that sort of augmented reality style, you know, where you're kind of combining the motion control element with the screen as kind of a viewfinder and all, there is potential there. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the proof is going to be in the pudding as to whether Nintendo can make it work. But I mean, if anyone can, they can. I mean, that's where I think, you know, compared to Vita, you know, Sony is not going to have all their top developers say, okay, let's focus on this whole Vita PS3 connectivity thing and how they can interact together. You know, they're not going to come up with the same kind of stuff that Nintendo are going to come up with when that's the whole thrust of their next home console.
Sure.
And so that really should be where it's decisively more impressive usage of this kind of two-screen home gameplay. Now, that's somewhat separate from the fact that Vita may do very well in Japan. I mean, who knows? It's got something to build off with PSP, certainly. Yeah.
Well, the other part is that he's describing the Wii U as competing with hand portables, and I guess in some sense that's true, but I would see this more as competing with the current and next generation HD consoles from Sony and Microsoft. And I sincerely hope that's what Nintendo is looking at this as, because this is a home console. It is connected to an HDTV and home sound system. It is in a format where you can be, you know, provided with longer, more cinematic experiences or, you know, more detailed environments. And so, I mean, I would hope that this isn't seen as competing with the Vita. It's competing with the PS3. And will Wii U be able to compete with the 360 or PS3? I don't know. They have to have compelling software to say, yeah, I'm willing to buy another HD system. Because a lot of people already own PS3 and or 360. So
yeah, they've built up very, you know, globally. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. They've built up big user bases now. Certainly PS3 has sort of very much got into the realms of respectability in Japan specifically. So Nintendo will have to compete with them there. And the asymmetric multiplayer, I don't think should be written off either.
No, I think it's great.
Yeah.
There could be some really fun stuff with that. And again, that does play to their whole Japan thing of having fun in the same room. So it's, you know, they're kind of attacking that problem that Massimo describes in Japan from two directions now. They're bringing you a new kind of fun, communal local multiplayer experience and a new way to not sort of alienate everyone around you by just putting it on the screen. So it's hard to deny the Japan centricity of their approach.
Yeah, but I'm not worried about denying it, though. I think it's I don't think it's quite entirely driven by the concern of Japanese television placement, as this email makes it out to be.
Not entirely, no.
I think to an extent Nintendo said, well, this is an interface we can use to create game experiences that our competitors can't do.
Yeah, and if they do that from the outset, unlike with the 3DS, and they have, whatever, Retro developing some sort of Western developed things, first-person shooter or whatever, and they have Pikmin at launch, and they have who knows what else from third parties, and they follow
that
up
pipe dream right
with
there.
You know, the things 2 or 3 months out that are also solid, like they did on the GameCube with, you know, Smash Brothers shortly after launch, you know. So right. I mean, if they can really demonstrate, yes, we're serious about actually providing good content, novel content, content you want, I think it'll stand on its own as a home console.
I think it's a good point you raise there about the timing of the software proving the worth of this particular hardware design and feature set, because you've seen with the kind of lukewarm reception at E3, the press wasn't necessarily entirely convinced. So investors seem to react quite a bit more negatively, actually. You know, the news wasn't good for Nintendo.
I thought the press reaction was generally fairly positive.
It was fairly positive, but there was a lot of like, well, there's no real games here, you know, that kind of
very
stuff.
It's very unlike Nintendo. I mean, I guess they did this with a DS too, now that I think about it, where they had just a bunch of tech demos.
But those things actually came out as games.
Yeah, some of them were closer to being real games.
But I would agree, actually. The people that played, we were probably quite a bit more positive than the vibes that you got from outside the show. Nintendo talked about a problem that they didn't really communicate well enough to people outside. That's something we've talked about before, but that's what I mean. I mean, to the people who haven't played it yet, it seems like there's a certain amount of skepticism about whether this concept is really worthwhile and all that. So I think if you want to stop that skepticism in its tracks before it becomes a snowball of you know, you get a perception problem, they need the killer software much more out in front than they've had it with 3DS, because with 3DS you had a lot more goodwill and favorable perceptions coming into it.
Oh yeah, they could charge $300 for this thing. No, they can't.
And they squandered that quite readily with a weak opening. So I think with Wii U, the bar is quite a lot higher. They've got to come out stronger. That, as we've said before, that augurs well for a later release.
Yeah. See, I think comparing my experiences with the two systems, which is difficult now because I recognize that I'm relatively privileged compared to the average consumer. The 3DS had a much more wow moment, but my initial experiences with the Wii U, despite the fact that it's much less of a game what we played, I mean, for me, the penultimate experience there was the
pirate game.
Yeah, the pirate game.
The Rhythm Heaven style pirate.
Yeah, and the most gamey thing there was a game that's not even in alpha phase, the Ghost Recon game.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it felt like a much easier sell because the pirate Rhythm Heaven style game, I mean, you looked like the biggest doofus on the show floor at E3, which is a huge bar to get over. That is a high bar. But you looked like that playing it. I mean, you looked embarrassing. But it was actually a lot of really stupid fun. And it's the same kind of stupid fun that you had when you played Wii Sports Tennis.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty for them will be getting these relatively expensive controllers in people's hands, but I think once they do, it'll be very easy for them to make the sale.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I think, you know, in terms of have they got a chance against Apple and Sony and all that, it's like, yes, they do, because Nintendo have proven, you know, time and again that their exclusive software has the capacity to get people to buy systems. So, I mean, I think they could survive, they can make profit. I guess the question is whether they're going to shrink down to a niche again rather than being in the lead. You know, that would be my question. But the one thing I would say about tablets is that, you know, I don't know whether they've really taken on the kind of communal aspect yet of what Nintendo captures with gathering around the same TV. So I don't know that they're going head-to-head quite yet in that
way. And what I find missing in this comparison, though, is that tablets don't tend to have buttons. And this is a traditional gameplay experience. You don't have to use the screen at all. I think in a way, there's more flexibility in play here. I mean, yes, you can make on-screen buttons, but...
No, you don't want to.
Anybody who's played Resident Evil 4 on an iOS device knows that is the dumbest idea Capcom has ever had.
I didn't play that, but I did play Dark Void Zero on my iPhone, and that was a terrible, terrible idea.
I think the experiences you're going to be able to get on this piece of hardware are different than what you're going to be able to get on any piece of downloadable software for a tablet.
Yeah, different market. You're going after a different style of game.
This goes back to Iwata's speech about decreasing the value of games. But, you know, while he said that in about the worst way he could have possibly said it, I have seen economists say that the era of the $1 game is unsustainable.
Well, I mean, that would be the sort of the race to the bottom that Iwata is forecasting.
I would say it would behoove them, though, to maybe start putting together a team whose only job it is to funnel good mid-tier downloadable content to their next hardware. I mean, that's become a large part of people's gaming diet.
Well, I think it's easy to see in the future that is going to be a growth market and retail may well be a declining market. And so if you want to continue to grow, you've got to be a player in growth markets.
Well, and you have to start now. Like, they need to really get on it well in advance of the Wii U launch. They need to be ready for this. There's no more launching your shop 6 months after the system comes out. You need to be ready.
All right, well, we're going to move on to the next question now. And TYP, I believe you have this one.
David writes, "You know the UDraw tablet? I saw store price calling it the Wii UDraw. And that made me think, well, will people confuse the Wii U's tablet controller with the UDraw? Yes, I think they will. But
probably.
I just don't know how well known the UDraw is, though.
They actually are releasing the UDraw for other systems.
Oh, really? Well,
yes.
I mean, it's just, I mean, for me, I don't think it's going to be a huge problem or anything. It probably will happen that people might get a bit more confused about it, although it depends how the UDraw sort of stays on shelf space, you know, from now until the Wii U actually comes out. But it's just another reason why they shouldn't keep the Wii U name. I really feel quite strongly about it. It's just...
Some kid will get a Wii Wii UDraw for Christmas.
It's just, yeah, as we've said, you know, there is kind of a problem with the way it's named and the nature of the device that people may perceive it as something that either is or perhaps should be an add-on to the Wii rather than an entirely new platform. And then the fact that you do have a peripheral for the Wii that's called the UDraw just kind of illustrates why that kind of perception might happen and reinforce it. So it's just... That name is a loser.
Yeah,
get off it.
I mean, it's actually a little bit like the transition from the NES to the Super NES. In that, in those days, you know, a lot of people that hadn't owned video game systems had a Nintendo Entertainment System, and their parents were like, wait a second, there's this new system out here, and it can't play the old games, and, you know, why should I have to pay for this? And I think it's a similar kind of market right now where there are a bunch of people that maybe are first-time, you know, console owners. You know, they bought a Wii because it was a cool thing to do. And they may not have the same understanding, appreciation for the console hardware life cycle. You know?
Yeah. And therefore, I mean, you know, at least with the Super Nintendo, it's called Super Nintendo. I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, in many ways that it's trying to distinguish itself as beyond what's currently available. It's just this experience that they've had with the 3DS and the DS where, as we've said before, the UK commercial with "this is not DS." Yeah, literally, you know, if they've had that problem.
Yeah, you know, I have to think Nintendo's thinking about this right now, too. I mean, given what they're doing with 3DS, I mean, they're not going to make this commercial and then say, well, this won't be a problem for the next system.
Well, you got this, guys. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar. It's a difference of one unique code character or maybe even a ASCII character.
We're good, guys. Don't worry. Nobody's ever going to confuse these two.
Okay, well, we're going to move on to the next question now. This is from Noah, and he writes, I recently played through Chrono Trigger and loved it. And I've also picked up Final Fantasy 3/6 on the Virtual Console. I know that John is playing Mass Effect as well, so my question is, what are the major differences between Japanese and Western RPGs? And what are the crowning achievements of both? I know that James plays a considerable amount of RPGs, so I would greatly appreciate it if he could answer my question.
Linearity. That's the difference.
I don't know. Final Fantasy III is quite non-linear in the second half.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, you end in the same place.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a certain more heavy story-driven storytelling element to Japanese RPGs in general than there are to their Western counterparts, which are more like, we're going to put you in a world. There is a story. There might not be a hard narrative, but I mean, there's backstory. There's a reason why you're in a wasteland, because you're always in a wasteland. that explains how it became a wasteland, and you have to fix why it's a wasteland, or go experience the wasteland. And
it's interesting, the differences between the two, because, I mean, Johnny's expressed before that he's not a big fan of the Western kind of RPGs. He's just sort of trying to kind of get into it. Mass Effect is somewhat like that, you know, but it's a bit more actiony than your typical one. He's played Fallout New Vegas now. I mean, so he's getting there. But, you know, why do you think that someone like Johnny would find JRPGs a lot more appealing?
I think
as someone who plays a lot of both, I mean, you played the shit out of Dragon Age and all that kind of stuff.
I think they're just much less daunting. I mean,
yes. That's exactly
really,
the issue.
You just go in and the game takes you along. Your only real concern is that you've built your characters, that you've leveled your characters up enough and you have the right equipment. In a Western RPG, it's like, shit, did I assign one too many points to his charisma? Mm-hmm. Damn it. Now I need to assign that to his accuracy. And then it's a much higher barrier to get that right. And it's where they come from. I mean, really, JRPGs are so heavily leveraged in anime and manga that they're almost inseparable in some ways. Versus a lot of Western RPGs, not all of them, are much more heavily leveraged in stuff like Dungeons and Dragons. And to an extent, those two things are pretty incompatible. So it's very easy to say JRPGs can just feel like you're being kind of led along for the journey because their source material is passive media. Versus a Western RPG where their source material are grid sheets with numbers on them.
Yeah.
Mm.
And to an extent, I mean, I'm overgeneralizing here.
Oh, of course. I mean, because there's been a lot of crossover between.
Right. And I would say the two Mass Effect games that we have do feel, in terms of their storytelling approach, much more heavily in the JRPG camp. And the stat emphasis is much lower in those games than it is in things like Fallout.
Yeah.
I would say that it's not a middle ground. I mean, it's a Western RPG, but it definitely has some elements of the JRPG in it.
I think you're absolutely right, James. I mean, I know Johnny and I have very similar feelings on the RPG genre. I enjoy JRPGs. I can't stand, you know, Dungeons and Dragons type Western RPGs. And it's for a lot of those reasons. I mean, I'm not interested in spending time crafting my own character. You know, it's kind of like the old example of, okay, first thing you do when you get in the game, you build a character and you have no idea what these stats actually do. And
right.
you're tasked with allocating them or relying upon the computer to do so.
Without context or any sort of guidance.
And there's some exceptions, you know.
Sure.
Dragon Quest IX, you build your own characters. But by and large, that's the case. And the Japanese culture cares a lot about characters. This came up in the Famicast. And it's like you said, that, you know, very much they care about characters from manga, television. You know, they want to have iconic characters. It's the exact opposite for Dungeons and Dragons. It's all about you creating your own character.
Right.
And owning your own character.
They are a stand-in for you.
They are diametrically opposed. And even where, you know, in games like Zelda, where arguably Link is a stand-in for you because he has no real personality, he's still a character. He still has a look, and that doesn't change.
Well, or if it does change, it still has iconic figures in it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he's gone from being big and little and a cartoon and all that, but he's still recognizable.
He always has a hat.
The green.
He always wears green.
Always using a sword.
He always uses that sword, for the most part.
So, James, have you got any thoughts on what you'd like to sort of denote as the crowning achievements of these genres?
I mean, that's tricky because it's
I don't.
The crowning achievement of JRPGs. I mean, holy hell. One thing I would say for me personally, from a Western RPG standpoint, to me, the first Mass Effect is probably the most well-connected I felt to a Western RPG game. And to an extent, it's because even though the character is your own creation, there's still a strong narrative and there's a certain amount of... You can still sort of pick your way through by building a character, but it's not so obtuse that you have to worry about assigning points to somebody's dexterity and then realizing, oh, this gun is actually more concerned about my endurance. But... I mean, that's a personal preference. I know people who swear up and down that things like Fallout are the ultimate expression of game. In terms of a JRPG, because RPGs are so diverse, it really comes down to which RPG is my favorite that day. And I don't think I can answer that question beyond, or in any way that would provide any sort of clarity.
Yeah, that's fine. I thought it might be a tough one, to say the least.
I think my inability to answer it almost is the best answer I can give you.
All right, well, we're going to move on to the next letter, and this one James is going to handle.
Reagan writes, "Hey, I was wondering what you guys think about game length. Do you like long or short games? How long is too long? How long must a game be in order to make it worth the price? The reason I'm asking is that I still haven't beaten Dragon Quest IX, and I bought it during the launch week. Conversely, I bought Ghost Trick for $30 and only played it for 7 hours. Great game, but the length and ending were slightly disappointing."
First of all, it's nothing disappointing about a Ghost Trick ending.
No, Ghost Trick is an amazing game.
Yeah.
But the ending is like, fuck!
I don't know how you can be disappointed by the ending. You can get an aneurysm from the ending, but disappointment...
It's like you don't think the game could get more mental, and then it gets more mental. I really like it.
7 hours doesn't seem right for that game either. I feel like it's longer than that.
A little bit longer. Depends on how quickly you read it. It depends on how good you are at solving the puzzles.
Yeah.
You know, or how quickly you care to solve the puzzle.
I mean, I think I did it in 3 or 4 days, but I mean, I also had to get the review out, so there was...
Yeah, but I played it pretty condensed, just so I wanted to keep going. It was a lot of fun.
Same here.
I mean, you'd definitely be done... I mean, Johnny hasn't been done with it so quickly, although apparently he's getting near the end, folks. I can give you that inside information. But I mean, for me, I wanted to keep going. I was totally absorbed.
Well, and that's been the case for the Phoenix Wright games, too. So, I mean, it's a very similar feel.
I mean, that's Shutsukumi.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've never cared too much about length of a game. I mean, if something's really short, like two hours or something, yeah, I'm, you know, like Kirby's Dream Land for the Game Boy, yeah, that's too short. But, you know, as for whether I'm willing to spend $30 on a game that's 5 hours long, yeah, if I really enjoy it. Yeah, because, I mean, length often means that you're spreading out the enjoyment over a longer period of time, and that's not good either. So, you know, if something is 5 hours long, it's punchy, it's fun, you know, there isn't a lot of downtime, that's awesome, that's great, especially for people like me that are busy now and don't have too much time to play games.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of people's preference in terms of, like, you know, do you like long or short games? Obviously, that's a very general question, you know, sort of smoothing over a lot of differences in genres and all kinds of stuff. But broadly speaking, a lot of people, as they get older, are going to tilt towards the short variety. I think that's a pretty general trend you could observe. But for me, it's never been something that's bothered me that much. I mean, I remember the core knock against Sin and Punishment when that was coming out for the N64 in terms of, you know, do you want to import this because, you know, it's going to be expensive, is, oh, well, it's so bloody short. And of course it is, but it's just so good for someone like me that it's worth it. You know, I mean, you just don't get that anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, no one does what that game does the way Treasure does it. So that is worth a lot to me. It's not all about length. I felt like the entertainment value was dense, which is in itself valuable.
Yeah.
So I don't have a single answer in terms of how long is too long or, you know, do I like long or short. I do like both, but there's no formula. It's a gut feeling about how intense the entertainment was that you got out of it.
To me, it's difficult because if I know a game is short, even if I know it's a good game, it's hard for me to know if that game is going to be dense enough until I've already plunked down the cash for it.
Yeah, that's tough to quantify, like just reading from reviews and stuff. That's the thing. It's easy in reviews or just talking with your friends, all that. It's nice to be able to talk about things that are easily quantifiable, like how many hours has it got or this, that kind of stuff, because those are terms that do have a certain amount of universality to them. But the pleasure that I derive from the bosses in Sin and Punishment is not quite so easily commensurable.
Right. So, I mean, I do enjoy having long games at my disposal.
And burning through them in inhumanly high speeds.
Well, not so much recently, but that's just due to lack of them to burn through.
But you're fixing that soon.
In times four, which is probably
is that,
not...
Is that like the latest sequel to Final Fantasy X?
No, it's... no. But, I mean, I went through Enslaved, which is a relatively short game.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe about 10 hours. And I enjoyed Enslaved, and I thought it was a really great game, and I felt like it was the right length. But that game, I couldn't justify paying $60 for it. Like, it just doesn't feel like $60 is even 10 hours worth of entertainment doesn't feel, you know, that kind of value for me. If I'm going to put down that kind of money, I want to get something with a little bit more meat on it.
And by meat, you mean something denser or something longer?
It needs to have some level of length, because that's opportunity cost now. I'm not going to be able to get another game to fill that time.
Yeah.
But it needs to have substance. It needs to have something that really holds with me for a while. So here's a game that isn't that long that I paid full price for. So Nine Persons, 9, 9, 9, 8, 7. I paid $35 for it at the time. Now, I didn't want to pay $35 for it, however...
Well, who does? I mean, we'd all like to pay...
It was basically the only copy that may have existed on the East Coast of North America at that particular moment. So, I paid what was the asking price. That game isn't especially long, but I found that it was so utterly engrossing that the price wasn't an issue. And in the end, I ended up replaying it multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that's difficult. You know, in a review, some people might say, you know, has it got replay value and all that, but...
Or our made-up word, replayability.
Yeah, that's a tough one in terms of... You know, there are some games that people would say are replayable that I was just content to have one go through.
But then on the
other hand, there are games that I would play to death, like Sin and Punishment for High Score or whatever, that, you know, probably a lot of people would be just relieved to be able to beat it and never touch it again.
Yep, that's the way I was.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, it's a personal element to it. It's very difficult to sort of translate those notions of value.
Yeah, I think for me personally, I like to have long games that are broken up by these quick, you know, high energy experiences. And what I find is I don't tend to burn those as fast. You know, after 2 or 3 hours, you're like, all right, I got to step away. Because it's overwhelming to play something like that in a straight shot.
I don't know. I played like 8 or 9 hours of Super Mario Sunshine when I first got it.
Oh, God. I did that too.
I skipped lunch.
I did. It was the summer holiday after finishing school. And I was just like, I played the fuck out of that thing.
Well, I did that for Galaxy too, but...
You had to. You were obliged to.
That was really painful. I mean, it was like...
No, I mean, I played Galaxy 2 to death, but I didn't play it for hours and hours on end. Cause
I played it for hours and hours on end, but, you know...
I mean, I was busy at the time with editing the show and everything else, and the World Cup was on, which ended up being the worst sporting event in the history of mankind. But the point is, that game can be satisfying in short playthroughs because it's like you pick a challenge, you beat it. You pick a challenge, you beat it. So you certainly don't have to play it for
true,
big
but there's to me in games like that, the high energy games, there's a certain level of mental fatigue that picks up after a while.
That's true.
I could see that
versus anything made by Tri-Ace, where there's no mental fatigue.
All right, well, we are now going to wrap up this big bumper batch of listener mail with some questions we've received about video game music. And, I mean, we've got here the two people that I would certainly choose to have for such a discussion with. James, who you might remember if you've listened to the show consistently over the years, is something of a classical musician. And
something of.
Yeah, well, it just sounds like you've not been, you know, doing it so regularly.
No, not in a while.
But, and then TYP, of course, the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. So let's get into it. I'll read, this is from Skytar, who, by the way, was the poor fellow that suggested that Mario Kart 7 wasn't such a bad name.
It isn't. I like it.
I assume James is going to be a bit more charitable in his response here. So, Skytar writes, I'm going to college to obtain a degree in media music so that I can compose music for video games. And I was wondering what experienced gamers such as yourselves look for in video game music. And what kind of musical perks do you like about the way some games are composed? Also, what video game do you think has the best soundtrack?
Oh,
that's
man.
It. That's to go back to the what we had earlier about crowning achievements. That's an easy question to answer.
Oh, it's impossible.
I mean, we've talked about favorite soundtrack stuff before, so maybe we'll come back to that a little bit. But let's. What do we look for in a game soundtrack, James? Where do you start?
So actually, I'm going to use some examples of soundtracks that I hold in high esteem to explain where I'm going with this. And for the sake of illustration, the soundtrack I'm going to talk about right now is the Chrono Cross soundtrack.
Ah, yeah. I've heard wonderful things about this.
Which is, to me, might have the best introductory song of any game ever. The song that plays in the opening movie is phenomenal. But what the soundtrack does that I think is really good, and a lot of game soundtracks do this, is that they have a theme they have written. It's not. It's usually not a very complicated theme. It's an A part, so it's usually played by the melody, and it gets worked in many different ways, many different instrumentations, many different styles of music throughout the entirety of the game soundtrack.
Yeah, there's a leitmotif kind of technique.
This was something I was going to bring up too. I agree with you, James. I think it's one way that helps make a game feel whole and cohesive. And it's just fun to hear different variations on this theme.
And I think that you can use that theme as almost a sort of parallel to the game, especially if you're dealing with an RPG, to the game's plot. Mm-hmm. By how you transform that theme, you can sort of transform the emotion of the setting.
Yeah.
You have this theme that, in this context, is very light and airy. It's played with very staccato notes, dun 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 dun. And then you sort of elongate the notes. Maybe you drop it an octave. Maybe you play it with an instrument that's much more of a baritone sound. What you layer on top of the song stylistically is very different. And you can create a song with essentially the same melody that's very morose, that has a grave to it.
Yeah, the classic example of this in Nintendo terms is Super Mario World, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
that
uses the same melody for the entire game. I mean, there are exceptions, but it's most of them just have that same ba-ba-ba-da-ba-da, you know, whether it's the ghost house or the castles. Mm-hmm. You know, they have radically different versions to make them sound menacing or ominous or that kind of thing, but it's the same melody, and it's kind of amazing at times that they stretch it as far as they do. And it's something I like, that there's something in the soundtrack that gives the game a feeling of consistency, but at the same time does also take you on a journey.
Right.
Yeah, I think other ways to achieve similar goals, having certain sound to the game or perhaps across games, like you know, maybe you have a certain instrumentation or set of instruments that you kind of can associate with the soundtrack of a game. For example, like a lot of the Capcom Mega Man games have a certain sound to them. There's a certain 8-bit instrument that, or set of instruments or harmonies that just sort of, that's Mega Man.
Yeah, there was a Radio Trivia before I was on staff, a live one, where I basically sent you every Mega Man game I could think of. And then missed it because it was X Collection and not one. Yeah. And I sent every X game, but not X Collection.
So I mean, there are other ways to do this too. So, certain really distinct instruments, like Johnny mentioned that weird kind of sitar instrument that they have in like Mario 64.
Yep.
And that's very distinctly like 3D Mario. It's reprised in various games and various situations. It's like, yep, that's 3D Mario.
It'll always remind you. I mean, it's in like New Super Mario Brothers to an extent, or obviously they have it in the when they reprised the Bowser theme in Galaxy, the first Galaxy, when it wasn't the orchestrated version. Immediately I just think of that summer 96 importing an N64. Mm-hmm. Because that instrument, you hadn't heard it in a game before, really, I guess.
They added it to the chip just for that game.
the non-existent chip in the N64.
And of course, some games do more localized flavor of variations on a theme, more like Sonic series often has different variations on the same theme for different, say this right, different acts of his own. And there are other games I've played, like Pac-Man World 2, that have do similar thing. Beyond sort of themes and reprising them, other things I look for in games are, you know, does it fit the context? And you talked about this a little bit, James, but like in a Mario game, and this is something I think maybe Koji Kondo or one of the other composers Nintendo has talked about, but like an action-y game, you want the soundtrack to be well-paced. Like the music should have a pace that matches the pacing of the game, and they can reinforce each other. Like when I'm playing a Mario game, it's very hard for me to play it without the music. As weird as that may sound to some people, and you know, Johnny almost never plays games with the music on, but for me, it helps give me a rhythm. It's almost like, you know, a rhythm game in some weird, perverse way. It helps pace, you know, how quickly I jump, and, you know, just gives me a comforting feeling.
So I have another thing that sort of connects a few of the ideas we've spoken about. We discussed, you know, games having a flavor of sound that goes with them. But I like to pin it more down to a game fits a world. The music fits the world of a game. And the series that does this really well for me is actually the however many Professor Layton games there are at this point.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's a great choice because it's a kind of style of music you haven't heard a lot in other games, so you just associate that style of music. If I mean, there's like a car commercial, I can't remember what company it is here, that's got a bit of, you know, accordion going. And you can't help but think of Professor Layton. Just by, I mean, so, you know, having played three Layton games, I must have played them for quite a while, and just at some point the very instrument becomes associated with them.
So that particular style is called bal musette. It's like a French bar style of music. I mean, it's the best way I can come up with describing what it is. what they do with that music, not only does it sort of give the sort of rustic feel of the game, it sort of matches the artistic style of it.
Yeah, it's a European animation style that they're going for. So
it feels the game feels a bit dated. You know, everybody's dressed in slightly dated attire. Even the cars they drive have sort of an older vibe to them. The whole world feels a bit in an unplaceable past.
It's out of time. It kind of reminds me of the Burton Batman, which, you know, was sort of contemporary, but then sort of in the 30s with the giant flash bulbs on the cameras and all that. You know, it's like alternate history kind of stuff.
But what the music does so well in that game is it has a great deal of variation in style. And in preparing for this question, I actually went through and hammered all three soundtracks of the DS games. And what I found is that the actual composition capacity of the team, Nishimura, I believe is the name of the composer, his ability has increased in making the music reflective of the action. You know, he's dropped just, I'm going to make music with accordions. And it started introducing things like in a song where basically the professor has nothing to go on at this point. He and Luke just know something is going weird in this town, and they're just looking for any kind of hint. He's replaced, you know, what would normally be just his accordion droning with this sort of pizzicato dun 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 dun. It's almost sort of this kind of ponderous walk, because they're just walking through town looking for something that's off.
I mean, thinking the Layton games, it's important because the world is in static artwork, you know, and I know you could say this about some older games, you know, from the 16-bit era, the 8-bit era, or whatever. I think music had to do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of creating the world.
Sure.
Sure.
It would not only set the mood of the story, but be the voice of the world. And so I think Layton is kind of a more contemporary example of that. Obviously, it's not like chiptunes or whatever, but it's still doing that.
In the third game, There's two places where this comes into play that's really interesting. Is there's this like Asian part of town where it's supposed to be all super seedy. It uses Eastern motifs, which is a lot of minor keys,
pentatonic scales.
Yeah, and these intervals that you don't normally hear in Western music, and it uses those, but it uses them with bal musette instrumentation, which is kind of weird. It connects it back to the game, but it sounds very odd.
Yeah, and also it kind of goes to the fact that it is fake, If you know what I mean, like
everything in Leighton is fake.
It's something inauthentic about it, and the fact that you've got the sort of mismatch of the instruments with the, you know, the composition, essentially, I think conveys that sense.
The soundtrack is almost a character. It does things in the game. It almost exposes some characters for who they really are before the story does. That's kind of impressive.
I mean, that's something I like in video game music, is when it's more than just setting the scene or, you know, sort of acting as a score for events, you know. Because, I mean, in many ways it can't, you know. I mean, cinema scores, everything that happens is completely plotted out and you compose the music according to that. Whereas, of course, in a game, it's typically spontaneous. You know, something that I think Tommy Tallarico talked about when we did that interview Johnny did, that's on our feed. You know, that's one of the challenges that video game music has, is that it has to sort of do some of the same things that a film score would do, but in a different way, because it has to reflect the fact that a bunch of different things could be happening with a game.
Right.
But also, I think it kind of goes to a lot of what we've been saying, but a slightly different slant on it in terms of cohesiveness. So we've talked about cohesiveness with the world, you know, cohesiveness with maybe the gameplay and stuff. But I also like games where the music has very good cohesive sense with the rest of the sound design, the sound effects and all that kind of stuff. Like Mario is a classic example of this, where, you know, it's almost hard to imagine the music without those classic jumping sound effects and the coin collecting and all that. You know, I mean, they almost become part of the music and they go together. That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, it works. And even so, going all the way forward to something like Mario Galaxy, sometimes, you know, it's kind of difficult to imagine some of those songs without the chinking of the star bits being collected and all this kind of stuff. So even when you go to the full orchestra or something like that, I think you could still have, you still need to take that kind of care that it all fits together. And there was actually one example I kind of wanted to bring up about this, where that sort of didn't happen for me, that I thought was interesting, which is Braid. I played through a few months ago, and the music is quite pleasant, what there is of it, with the strings that has, you know, relaxed, pleasant kind of vibe to it. But the sound effects are just really lazy and you know, kind of like flash game type sound effects, you know, and they just don't fit together with this sort of, you know, this very high sounding kind of refined music with these pathetic sort of sound effects. It just that juxtaposition, if it was sort of meant to be one, did not work for me at all. So that's a case where, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the music per se, but its effect is undermined because it doesn't fit in with everything else. So that's the thing. I mean, you know, if you're Skytar and you're looking to compose music and all that, one of the things I love about video game music is it's so eclectic, it's so diverse. I mean, you know, you get to hear kinds of music in video games that you never would hear in other settings, whether it be movies or in the popular realm. You wouldn't be exposed to it, probably. So that's what I like about it. So it's difficult for me to say, well, I look for this particular thing, because I like finding the things I'm not looking for. But I would say, just always remember, you know, you are making something that's part of a whole. And that's really how you got to look at it, that it's got to fit and it's got to embellish what else is there.
Right. And I think it a big part, at least from what I've experienced about composition, and I was a terrible composer, so I can, but I know many people who are very talented composers. Once you can find your own voice for how you want to compose music, you can adapt that to pretty much any situation. But that first bit is so difficult. You know, it's all about getting to a point where just being comfortable with something, and then I think that comes through to the people listening.
Well, that is going to finish us up for listener mail this week. A hearty dose, I think you'd agree. But once again, we will need more, of course, after going through the reserves in this way. So send your letters to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We'll be getting back to them before too long. And so that's going to bring the show to an end. Just a few things I'd like to clear up before we go. Reviews on iTunes. I don't think we've mentioned this for a while, but you know, we always want more reviews on iTunes to help people find the show. And one particular thing I want to mention is that obviously I see the UK iTunes store, in which we have about 20 ratings, I believe. Now, in America, I think I have seen, you know, that how many ratings we've got on the US iTunes store, and that's about 160. Now, you know, doing your math there, The population of the UK is about a fifth of that in America, so we're still behind the pace. I need more. For my countrymen, I need more reviews. I know that there's got to be some of you out there. So this is the pledge that I'm making. If we can get to 30 ratings on iTunes before the Bills win two games, which last year took till about week 11 or something. This year, I'm hoping it's going to be quicker. But let's just say that before the Bills win two games, I will sing God Save the Queen on the show.
Oh, no.
As Gollum from Lord of the Rings. That is my pledge to you. I want those. I want to hit 30.
Okay, what if we want you to sing without singing it like Gollum? Does that require more or less?
I don't know. Maybe we can make this like a sliding scale or like the charity show. You know? But that, I need more from you. All our British listeners, we need you to pitch in. Certainly. Everyone else around the world is welcome if they'd like to submit a review as well. And it is indeed the start of the NFL season next week, and our regular recording time will be clashing with the opening game of the season, which involves Neil Ronahan's Packers against the Saints. So our recording time will be disrupted, as it's kind of our usual time. It clashes with that game and this year a joint session of Congress. So we will have to sort of reorganize things a little bit, but we will have a show next week of some description. Not sure what the format's going to be or who's going to be on it quite yet, but we're going to have one. So no need to worry about that. And so hopefully we'll be able to get John and Lindy back in some fashion, because I miss them. And of course I want to thank TYP for coming on and being our guest this week. Excellent job.
My pleasure.
And of course, Radio Trivia, would you like to fill us in on the latest goings on?
Sure. I recently posted an episode with Zach Miller, and I thought it was a pretty good show. There's one game in particular that is themed on evolution that results in some interesting conversation. So I do encourage you to check that out. If you like the discussion of video game music in this episode, obviously you hear a bunch of video game music on our podcast, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, the full title. And you can find it on iTunes, or you can get to it from our website. And of course, feel free to review us on iTunes.
Yeah, we sure we could set some sort of benchmark to get.
I'm not promising any songs.
No Star Spangled Banner. No.
No, I promise I will not reprise the Tails theme from Sonic Adventure if I get sufficient.
Oh, God.
Get sufficient reviews.
That is a good promise. Okay. So yeah, and then of course there's the newscast coming out every week at the minute. Be sure to check that out as well. And so, James, thanks for joining me as always.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to do it for this week, so we'll see you next episode. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. God, now I got it stuck in my head.